Thank you very much for coming this evening. The subject of my talk tonight was entitled Cultivating Joy, but I'd actually like to explore with you the many different forms of joy, or these positive mind states that we see in the Buddha's teaching on the path to liberation. Delight and gladness and happiness and contentment and all these wonderful mind states. So as many of you know, the Buddhist path has as its spiritual goal Nibbana, which is the extinguishing of greed, hate, and delusion. And it's extinguished to the extent that it never arises again. So when I was here in October, I gave a talk on this this sutta in which the Buddha describes the flow of what's usually translated into English as liberative dependent arising. And it's a series of factors that when you plant the seed and it grows and develops and matures, the next state is going to be born automatically. It's just going to arise, you know, like you plant a tomato seed, and eventually you're going to get a little tomato plant, you know. And it's the same for each of these mind states. So the progress along this path towards liberation is really very organic. So I'll just go over with you briefly what these mind states are that we're working on in the course that, well, we're working on half of them, not all of them, that I'm teaching with some of you. So the first one is meeting our suffering with wisdom. So it's really interesting that the path to freedom, the door to that is opened when we start to have enough discernment and mindfulness and wisdom to respond wisely to our suffering instead of being reactive. If we're reactive, we're just going to be stuck on the wheel of samsara, this wheel of becoming. And if we can cut through that reactivity and respond skillfully, that's the fork in the road. And instead of being hooked to the wheel of suffering, suddenly we're on a different track that's going to end up eventually with liberation. So that's a sort of the key door opener to this whole path towards Nibbana. And once we do that, and that becomes sort of confirmed that we've gotten a really good handle on our reactivity, and we're now responding skillfully to our suffering, that in turn gives rise to confidence or faith in the path, because we see for ourselves that we're not hooked to our suffering anymore. We're actually, you know, we're actually glad to be not hooked to that anymore. So we have confidence that, wow, yeah, this is a path that I want to be on. It's letting go of greed, hate, and delusion. Sounds good to me, you know. And so that confidence is born. And then as the confidence develops, the more you do it, it's all coming from your own spiritual practice. It's all coming from your own lived experience. It's not something you have to believe in. But you see for yourself that when you stop being so reactive and start being more skillful, that it's a really good thing, and you want more of it. And you start to have this unshakable confidence in the path of the Dharma, because you've seen your own, how your own life has changed from that. And then when confidence comes to fruition, the next factor that arises spontaneously, naturally, is gladness. You're glad to be on the path, you know, and it's a pervasive sense of gladness. And you know, we cultivated that a little bit in our guided meditation this evening. Gladness then, when it becomes mature, gives rise to joy. And you might say, well, what's the difference? Gladness is maybe more cerebral. I'm searching for the word, but it's more sort of concrete. But the joy that arises from gladness when that's mature is very, very, very deep. It's called piti in Pali, and it arises with deep concentration, inevitably. So when the mind gets concentrated, as our meditation improves, we start to have this, and sometimes it can be just a thrill, that you feel physically. Sometimes it's a bit softer, depending on, you know, your life circumstances or your, you know, where you're at. But it's a real rush. And again, it's so pleasurable that, you know, you want more of it. But of course, you know, what happens when we grasp onto something? But when this deep joy matures, that in turn allows for tranquility to arise. So it's interesting, you have this really uplifting factor of joy, and then you have to let go of that to be able to then let the mind settle further into, you know, being peaceful and being tranquil. And then it's tranquility that gives rise, when it is mature, to happiness or contentment. So happiness is, it's more like a beautiful deep lake. It doesn't have the thrill that the joy has, but it's much deeper and more pervasive. And it's happiness, in turn, that gives rise to samadhi. So we heard that, you know, I just said that one of the way joy arises spontaneously is with deep states of concentration. And so samadhi is not just concentration. It's more like, it's often translated as concentration in English, but it's more like unification. That, you know, there's just no separation anymore between the different parts of you, or between you and everything else in this world. And so it's a kind of unification. And then, so the first of these, through happiness, can actually be cultivated to some extent, but you can't cultivate samadhi because you have to get out of the way. You know, if there's a self doing it, it's not gonna work. So it's kind of like a gift of God, or a blessing that comes when this deep happiness pervades us and our lives. And then for the rest of the path, what comes after that is just like sort of like dominoes. You don't do it, but it happens when these mind states come to fruition. The Buddha sometimes compares it to the process as being just as natural as water flowing down a hill. I really love that metaphor because it's not like we're climbing this arduous mountain. It's like we're letting go, and then our practice kind of takes care of itself. So what samadhi does, that, and it's kind of, like I said in the beginning, the responding wisely to our suffering was the door opener to the path towards freedom. Samadhi is the door opener to liberation, in the sense that it's in the state of samadhi that we can see clearly. We really start to see things as they really are. Of course, we have many insights along the way, but what it's called yata bhuta jnana dasana in Pali, and that literally means knowledge and vision of things as they are. So that's the insight of insight practice. And then once that insight arises, it comes to fruition also, and it becomes unshakable, and it inevitably gives rise to disenchantment, meaning that we fall out of love with our delusions and our grasping and our whatever. And then being disenchanted, it's kind of like seeing through the magic show. That inevitably gives rise to dispassion. So dispassion is the word in Pali is viraga, which literally means fading away. Like if you have a cloth that's been dyed and you've washed it so many times, eventually the color fades away. And so it means that our grasping fades away completely. And when that happens, the natural consequence is liberation. And then with that, the knowledge of liberation. So that's the sequence that the Buddha describes. So I want to talk a little bit about emptying and awareness. And I want to make the distinction between what you might call ultimate practice and preliminary practice. Ultimate being these like really advanced states. I think most of us here are on the preliminary part for now, including me. And I'd like to read to you, it's kind of long, but I hope you don't mind if I read this to you. It's from an article that Gil Fronsdal wrote called Emptying and the Happiness of Practice. So so I'll just start with this. While emptying is not a term found in the Buddha's teachings, it describes the process leading to awakening. It's a process of freeing or emptying the mind of all proclivities that bring suffering, emptying ourselves of all the attachments that prevent us from realizing Nibbana. The practices connected to the path of awakening can be divided into two categories, those that focus on emptying and those that focus on awareness. Notably absent in the Buddha's models of the path are practices that are intentionally and directly focused on evoking particular mental states. For example, practices for cultivating generosity, compassion, and patience are not discussed in the early texts as elements of the path. So while the Buddha did teach these cultivation practices in certain circumstances, he did not include them as part of the path to awakening, perhaps because the path to awakening is more about stilling and emptying the mind than actively shaping it. It's through emptying and awareness that the mind is prepared for awakening by becoming, and he's quoting the Buddha here, concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. The path ends with a final emptying that leads to full awakening, which is called the supreme unsurpassed emptiness. This is when the three taints of sensual desire, becoming, and ignorance have been destroyed. The emptying practices at the start of the path are concerned with avoiding what's unskillful, and this emptying oneself of unskillful states is accomplished by such practices as abandoning, abstaining, relaxing, purifying, and letting go. And the emptying practices at the beginning of the path are directly associated with attaining happiness, delight, and joy. So even though you don't cultivate them per se, they come along with this emptying process. Gill goes on to say, the awareness practices connected to the path of liberation include mindfulness, clear comprehension, seeing, and understanding. These are associated with clarity and stillness rather than attaining happiness or joy. So both the emptying and awareness practices facilitate the natural flow to liberation. The emptying practices remove the obstacles to this unfolding, and the awareness practices stabilize the mind and reveal what needs to be let go of. The awareness practices also create greater receptivity and spaciousness of mind. The practices that involve abstaining and abandoning are associated with happiness and gladness. And now he's quoting from the Buddha, who says, abstaining from unethical behavior brings the happiness of blamelessness. Abstaining from attachments to sense objects brings an undefiled happiness. Abandoning the hindrances brings gladness and delight. And then Gill says, we might add the practice of contentment, which includes letting go of discontent, to this list of practices that bring well-being. And again, a concentration from the Buddha. When one is glad, joy is born. In one who is joyous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body becomes tranquil feels happiness. In one who feels happiness, the mind becomes concentrated. And then Gill says, the only effort that may be required is maintaining mindfulness and keeping the mental obstacles away. Whereas in the earlier stages of the path, the practitioner actively empties himself or herself of unskillful states in concentration practice, the action one actively does is to suffuse beautiful states throughout one's body. That's when you do the jhana practice. So to suffuse, fill, soak, and pervade this very body with joy, with happiness, with a mind thoroughly purified and cleansed. In this way, the movement of deepening meditation is not described as something willfully or actively done by the practitioner. It seems to arise from thoroughly enjoying the pleasurable states that arise. And indeed, the Buddha himself says, the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment, I say, this kind of pleasure should be pursued, that it should be developed, that it should be cultivated, that it should not be feared. So Gill's making the point that we're not doing so much cultivation, that it's basically emptying and then awareness. But we've just heard now that the Buddha says, I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, developed, cultivated, and not feared. So he is saying, to go ahead and cultivate these things. You know, the Buddha gave many, many, there's nothing absolute about the teachings of the Pali Canon. It's an enormous volume of work. The Buddha taught for 40 years. And he said different things to different people depending on, you know, what was going to help them. And so we as practitioners, if we're interested in these early texts, you know, you can't just cherry pick and take some things. You have to be discerning about what you pick up and what you don't pick up. So even though a so-called advanced practice might be one of emptying and awareness, I think that for most of us here tonight, we can really benefit from the cultivation of these positive mind states. But knowing that at some point we'll have to let go of them. You know, you can't get tranquility if you're still just like blissed out in the, you know, the joy. You know, you have to let go of that joy, and then tranquility can arise. So, how do we cultivate these positive mind states? And here I'm going to borrow from some of the teachings of Donald Rothberg. One thing that the Buddha has said is that the whole of the spiritual path occurs in the interval between feeling tone and grasping. So feeling tone in Pali is vedana, and every time we have sense contact, which we have in every moment, there is a feeling tone associated with that. It's either pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And it's that feeling tone that we have to watch out for, because if it's unpleasant, we're going to want to push it away. If it's pleasant, we're going to want more of it. If it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant, well, we might be kind of confused about what to do. And so that's why he says it's at that, you know, how we respond to pleasant and unpleasant is whether or not we go into grasping. So, you know, as I mentioned at the outset, in this model of liberative dependent arising, the turning point is finding a different attitude towards our suffering. That's the door opener. So we see that suffering exists. This is the first noble truth, or the first liberating insight. And then we become aware that we've become caught in our suffering. And we also have the wisdom to know that suffering can be workable. It can be transformative, and that we can respond skillfully. And then, you know, as I said earlier, when we do that, confidence arises, and that gives rise to gladness, delight in having a path of practice. And another quality of delight is relaxation. So when we can deeply relax, well-being arises, happiness arises, we feel good. And feeling good in our meditation practice or in our life is something that helps also keep us on the path. It's a positive reinforcement. And so in that sense, it helps us to go further. We can know that there's a deeper gladness that contains absolutely everything. That, you know, no matter what's happening. I remember many of you have heard me talk about my youngest sister who died of ALS. And when she first got her diagnosis and told me about it, I just was in rebellion against the fact that such a beautiful person who has been so generous, so loving, so such a wonderful person could have this as their fate. And it took me going into a month-long retreat, and after about 10 days, I was, you know, I was pretty well concentrated, and but it had been about 4 months actually that I'd been sort of railing against the injustice of my sister's illness, and I finally dove into this ocean of tears. And what was really astonishing about that experience was that being really in this ocean of tears, 100%, there was joy in that. It was so unexpected. And so, you know, to me, this one of the things I learned from this is that, you know, really being present with your suffering and really embracing the truth of the suffering that there is in this world can actually have a remarkable element of joy to it. It seems really kind of ironic or contradictory, but so that's the gladness that contains everything. And then there's delight when the hindrances subside. So many of you know about the five hindrances: sense desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. And so when you go on retreat and you get into you get more settled, you actually can observe the hindrances falling away. And it's a wonderful feeling. There's delight in that. There's peacefulness in that, you know? And that's what allows you to become concentrated in your meditation. It's when you know, you've at least temporarily let go of the five hindrances. And then as you deepen your meditation and concentration starts to kick in, there's delight in that. There's, you know, it's a very positive feeling. Another thing is just being present for the natural world. You've all experienced something like this. You know, you see a little frog and you feel delight. Or you're walking along and suddenly your eye is caught by a drop of water on a leaf. And it's just so beautiful, the way the sun is lighting up this drop of water, and you feel just awe and wonder and delight, gladness to be alive. Just so that's another way we can actively cultivate these positive mindsets, taking the time to go for a walk in nature. I remember when I was at Tassajara in the Zen monastery. It's in a the Los Padres National Forest, inland from Big Sur, and it's really remote. It's in the middle of a national forest, and we didn't have electricity, you know. And I remember every night or every morning, depending on the time of year it was, looking up at the sky and seeing the constellation of Orion. My eyesight's never been very good, and so it's a really bright constellation. It was the one that I can see the best. But I remember just, you know, the sense of gladness I had that Orion was always there, and I kind of imagined that he was looking after me somehow, or, you know. So just looking up and, you know, and then delight can arise. Somebody here tonight Googled me and found me on the website of Suzuki Roshi's biographer. It's called Cuke.com, because his master called him Crooked Cucumber. Anyway, there is an interview with me. I think it was in 2012, and I shared that. So I'm a trauma survivor. So there's a lot of deep hurt inside that, you know, a lot of it has been healed. But when I started practicing in the monastery, you know, we meditated, I don't know, five times a day, something like that, on the ordinary days. And then there were also intensive sessions where we meditated all the time. But for the first 2 years I was there, I had tears streaming down my face every time I sat. You know, because there was, you know, this hurt that had to come up and be there. And in spite of that, I have sort of always felt that the 3 years I spent at the monastery were the happiest years of my life. And it wasn't because, you know, I wasn't going through painful stuff a lot. It was because, you know, practicing with that intensity, I was really present a lot of the time, you know? And there's just immense joy in simply being present for what you're doing, you know? You know, you rake the leaves, you really rake the leaves. Or whatever, you know? And that in itself is kind of wondrous. Then there's another thing that makes us very, very happy is when we live with integrity. So many of you have taken the training precepts, which are essentially non-harming. And when you start really living a life of non-harming and going deeper and deeper and deeper into the subtleties of how you might cause harm and then see them before you do it and, you know, abandon that, what arises is what the Buddha often refers to as the bliss of blamelessness. And it's blissful because you actually feel good about yourself. You know, you know that you're really doing the best you can not to harm even an insect, and certainly not to harm other people. And so living this life of integrity really allows you to feel good about yourself. And that, heck, that's pretty nice, you know? Simply resting and non-harming. And then another excellent way of cultivating joy or any one of these positive mind states is the practice of gratitude. It's a good one. This is actually a really good one to start with. You start just, you know, maybe beginning of every sit, take a few minutes, or first thing in the morning before you get out of bed, take a few minutes and think about what it is you appreciate, what it is you're grateful for in your life. And you know, some people like to make a journal of that. And just this simple practice of inviting gratitude, there's always something we can be grateful for. It does a fantastic job of helping us to cultivate joy. So one of the things that is kind of pervasive in our cultural conditioning as Westerners is that we tend to focus on our problems more than on our successes. You may know the teacher Rick Hansen, who wrote Buddha's Brain. And Rick says that problems are like Velcro and happiness is like Teflon. You know, we just, something negative comes up and boy, we just glom onto it and, you know, repeat it and, you know, let it influence us. And then we have absolutely extraordinarily beautiful, wonderful experiences and we don't even let it register. So this is another really skillful thing that we can do in our practice and in our lives, is that when we do have one of these wholesome, pleasurable experiences, stop and take a moment to take it in. Really take it in. And, you know, the advantage of doing that is that it ends up by changing our neural pathways so that it becomes that much easier next time to have one of these positive experiences. You know, what the Buddha always said, that, you know, whatever we think about and focus on, that's what we become. So if we are always focusing on what's wrong, well, that's just reinforcing staying in the pattern of what's wrong. So really taking in the goodness is always a valuable thing to do. And that's something you can do not just in meditation, but, you know, throughout your daily life. So, you know, it's true that since we're sort of conditioned to focus on our problems, it may take some intentionality, I think, for us to cultivate joy and these other positive mind states. And I wouldn't shy away from cultivating it because, you know, the ultimate is practice is emptying and awareness. You know, at this sort of early stage of practice for us all, I believe, I think it's cultivating is something that we can allow ourselves to do. And then another thing is that when we're really suffering, when maybe we're grieving or, you know, life is really, really hard, we can feel overwhelmed by our pain. And so cultivating these positive mind states can actually serve us as an antidote to the overwhelm. Of course, we have to be careful not to indulge in spiritual bypassing and sort of pretending that things aren't as bad as they really are. But, you know, being honest about our suffering, but then also intentionally, you know, cultivating some kind of gladness as a support in helping us to not be crushed by the feeling of being overwhelmed. And how many more of these do I have? Oh, there's a few more. Then there's just delighting in being alive. You know, you may have heard me say this before, but one of the things I remember best about Suzuki Roshi is that he said, it's enough just to be alive. That's kind of amazing. So that's a nice thing to remember. Another thing is what we practiced during the meditation is cultivating the Buddha's half smile that we see on many of these Buddha statues. We don't have any idea what the Buddha looked like, But the way he's portrayed artistically, there's very often this really gentle hint of a smile. And you may have seen in your experience tonight that actually can change the dynamic of how we sit. And then another important thing in cultivating joy is letting go of being judgmental. Anybody here ever been judgmental? Yeah. And that means judgmental of ourselves or judgmental of others. And there's an alternative to being judgmental. When we see that arise in us, we can say, oh, oops, and then turn on metta, which is unconditional friendliness to all beings. So that's something that we can actively do when the tendency to be judgmental rears its ugly head. Excuse me for judging it. Delighting in knowing that we have a path of practice and that we're all, I'm sure each and every one of us, we're doing our best. You know, it doesn't have to be perfect, but doing our best on this path of practice, which is sometimes arduous, that's amazing, and it's certainly enough. So that's another thing that we can have delight in, is that, yes, we have this path, and yes, we're doing our best, and yes, that's enough. It's pretty cool. And I think in the guided meditation this evening, I mentioned what's often referred to in the Mahayana tradition as our Buddha nature, which is, you know, it's this little golden Buddha inside each and every one of us that is who we are. And so opening to that also, that we have this universal potential for awakening. And that can be a great source of feeling good about oneself and being able to let go of feeling inadequate or celebrating this potential for awakening that each and every one of us has. I was going to, it's 8:52, I was going to read to you some two poems from the Charigata, but maybe we'd rather have Q&A. Oh, they're not too long. Okay, I'll read you the poems. This is from the Charigata, which Rich told you earlier is what I did my thesis on. And this is a canonical text in the Pali Canon, and it is a collection of poems of awakening by the Buddha's first women disciples. And so I'm going to read you, first of all, one by a nun named Uttama. And what her name means is highest, best, noble, or excellent. And she says, 4 or 5 times I left the monastery without attaining mental peace. I had no control over my mind. I approached a nun who was trustworthy. She taught me the Dharma, the aggregates, sense spheres, and elements. I listened to the Dharma as she instructed me. For 1 week, I sat cross-legged in one spot, given over to joy and happiness. On the 8th day, I straightened out my legs, and the mass of darkness burst open. So sitting there, given over to joy and happiness, was part of the process of awakening for her. even though she had, you know, she starts out saying that she had no control over her mind for such a long time and is ready to give up. And so the next poem I want to read you is by another nun with the same name. She's called Another Uttama. And it's a similar, it's kind of similar. She says, the seven factors of awakening, paths for the attainment of Nibbana, I have cultivated them all as instructed by the Buddha. I attained what I wished, that which is empty, signless. I am a true daughter of the Buddha, constantly enjoying release. Wait, these are translated by Gill, and release, he's rendering Nibbana into English. And then the last verse, all sensual desires, divine and human, have been severed. The wandering on in births is destroyed, and that means samsara. Now there is no more rebirth. So, thank you very much for your attention, and we do have a few minutes for discussion.
Number one, thank you very much for tonight. Very gives lots of room for reflection. As you were going through the kind of the into, as we move from gladness into joy, and describing that, and then into tranquility and into happiness, you could say, you kind of said, like, we, to get to the next space, we need to put aside the tranquility and then move to the happiness.
Well,
and
no,
I'm just looking for clarity in that. What happens to those things that we put aside to move on or to move down, whatever, you know?
Yeah. Thank you for your question. What I was specifically talking about was the sort of pitfall of joy, because it's so pleasurable that some people get caught in it. It's one reason we had the jhana wars back in the 80s, is, you know, teachers didn't want people just, you know, blissing out on being concentrated. And so to get to tranquility, you do have to let go of the joy, because the joy is so uplifting, it's almost exciting. But I don't think that you have to ever give up tranquility. Tranquility is something that you would stay with, and happiness also, and, you know, samadhi. But I was specifically talking about not clinging to joy, because it's tempting to, because it's so pleasurable.
So then what happens to it? Where does that go?
You let it go.
What does that mean? Do you let it go?
Or maybe it subsides by itself when it's ready to. As you know, as you move through the jhanas, you have joy in the first two, but you don't get to the third jhana with joy still present. In fact, the progression through the jhanas are states of concentration. The progression through them is like an emptying. You know, it starts out with five things present, all great things, and then it gets narrowed down and narrowed down and narrowed down, and then when you're at the end, you're in equanimity, pure equanimity.
But those those other parts or aspects are still within you, or I don't know if I'm making sense. It's like they fade away, Are they still part of your being? Are they still part of your...
Well, they come and go. You know, I mean, this is not a linear path. And, okay. You know, we go into and out of these states. And also, you know, it's one in which we revisit them at different times. Maybe it's more like a spiral than a straight line. So... you know, at some point we let go of certain ones so that others can arise, like tranquility, and then happiness, and then samadhi. But then after that, I'm not speaking from experience, but we. You know, I think we want to stay with samadhi as best we can so that we can finally have the insight that gives rise to liberation.
Okay, thank you.
You spoke of the deep trauma that you had, and you went on... You became a monk, or you went to a monastery, and you were there for 3 years. So the question is, how in the world did you find joy in that? And would you have found the same joy if you'd gone to a psychotherapist?
You wouldn't believe how much therapy I did before I went there.
Okay, so you did that before, and then it wasn't satisfying, or
no, it's not that it wasn't satisfying. Oh. It's that. I was a college student at the time, and I was taking a course in educational psychology. And the teacher said, you can't educate anybody else and let you know yourself. And he put 3 books on Zen on the reading list. And I was just flabbergasted by these books. And I said to myself, if Zen is happening anywhere in this country, it's got to be San Francisco. And I went all the way from Boston to San Francisco to spend my summer. And that's where I found Suzuki Roshi. Right away. So it wasn't that I had, planned to do that. But then, as soon as I heard him give a Dharma talk 5 days after I started sitting with him, I knew that I was in the presence of somebody deeply enlightened, and I had vowed right then and there to become his disciple. And you know, he was one of the most joyful, playful people you could ever want to meet, you know, as well as being he was a wonderful teacher. Anyway, so it's because I saw the value from his example. You know, here was somebody you could see the awakening. And all I wanted to do was to study with him.
So forgot your trauma? Or it just dissipated?
No, I didn't forget it. It's just that, I had to continue dealing with it, I'm sure I couldn't have done it without all the psychotherapy I had to begin with. And actually, I did go back into psychotherapy a few times after that. But the real, for me anyway, the real healing has come from meditation. And that's why I'm so grateful for this path.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's 9:03. There's a question over here. Okay, good.
Hi, hello, thank you. So earlier you were talking about the process is like water flowing downhill. So would you start at the top of the hill, or do you have to walk to the river first?
The Buddha didn't make that clear in his metaphor for that one. But there is another one of going to the top of a mountain and looking out and seeing things and having insight just from being able to see clearly in such a vast way. But I think the point he was trying to make is that awakening is a very natural process. And it's, of course, we have to learn skillful effort as part of our practice. I mean, he also said all the time, you know, practice tirelessly, there's lots of exhortations to, practice really earnestly. But that said, at some point, you do have to get out of the way. And all that earnestness turns into water rolling downhill. You know, the first the little creeks, and then the bigger creeks, and the river, and then finally the great ocean of freedom.
Would you have said when you went to the monastery, would that have been like when you were going as the river downhill, and then your time before that was getting to the river?
Yeah, a Zen monastery is certainly not rolling downhill. It's really tough. It's very arduous, yeah.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Okay. Thank you very much. May we and all beings continue on this beautiful path of awakening. May we and all beings know joy. May we and all beings touch into the natural inner peace that is always available. May we and all beings be free. Thank you for your practice.